The Guardian.
America's first space shuttle. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast...
The job of government is to actually say, if you're using a liquid that is becoming a drainage on our economy, we want to push you away from it.
Why the UK isn't going to be overrun by electric cars anytime soon.
For less than a week of what the country uses, gasoline or petrol, we can put a network across the entire country. And that number applies to Israel, and it applies to the UK, and it applies to any country in the world.
We never get bored of speaking to people who've actually been in space.
The initial rescue and repair of the Hubble Space Telescope probably had the most significance for other people in the world at large of any of the things that I've done in space.
As the shuttles prepare for their final liftoffs, we ask whether they would still have been scrapped if Challenger and Columbia were still flying.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
Plus, what do you think this is? No. It's the music of yeast. In fact, it's the sex life of yeast. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. As you hear this, I'll be in Washington, D.C. for the AAAS Science Festival. More on that later. But that means I've not really been around to record this week's programme. The team, however, have been busy in the background recording some smashing features to keep you all fascinated for another week. Let's start with my contribution, an interview I've been trying to get for years. While he was in London on a trip from the US, I finally managed to get Shai Agassi into the studio. He knows a thing or two about electric cars.
I'm Shai Agassi. I'm the founder and CEO of Better Place.
A pioneering sustainable transport firm from California.
We are a service provider, much like gas stations are service providers for gasoline cars. We build a network, and that network includes the ability to charge your car as well as to switch your battery as you go longer distance than the range that battery's. We started by putting two decisions in place. The first one is we realized that the places where you really charge your car are the places where you parked and left the car anyway, not where you come in as a destination to charge. And that's home and work. We spent about 22 hours a day at home and work, 2 hours in driving and 22 hours parked. And so we put a charge spot at home and a charge spot at work. And it eventually what it leads to is to the point where whenever you come back to your car from those long periods at home and work, you're full. Then you had to resolve for the long trip. And the long trip for us is about 3-4 hour trip is the sort of the usual long trip. It's the weekend trip to the coast or to a vacation resort, whatever it is that we do, depending on location, skiing. And those trips, we would be offering a service, which is the ability to switch your battery as you drive. We've built a machine that allows us to take a battery, a depleted battery, out and put a full battery in on the road. And we've actually demonstrated that machine working in Tokyo. And it did the switching on Tokyo on a taxi in less than a minute. And we've done this almost 10,000 times in our last 6 months, switching a battery in less than a minute.
Now, this sort of infrastructure question, it's a chicken and egg situation. If you don't have infrastructure, you can't have the electric cars. If you don't have electric cars, why build infrastructure? You're kind of doing both at the same time. How do you go about building that stuff and taking the risks? Do you have to get involved with governments?
So we broke $3 billion worth of eggs to get the chicken and egg problem solved, and we placed an order for 100,000 cars.
It's a big omelet
with Renault. It's a huge omelet. You can't get around that, because if in the car industry, if you don't do a volume program, it becomes a very expensive car. If you do 1,000 cars, you're looking at $100,000 a car. If you're doing 100,000 cars, you're looking at a $20,000 car. So there's a very big difference between small and big in this industry. And 100,000 is not considered huge, but it's considered volume enough to actually generate an industry. We went about by actually securing Renault first. When we had Renault, we secured $200 million. Since then, $500 million more. But we secured $200 million to actually go put the network into the ground in Israel. And when we had Renault and the $200 million, Israel came in and said, here's the regulatory framework that we put in place so that Israel can get off of oil within a decade.
So this is key, actually. Israel's a key part of the development of your company and is going to be the first place where a network is running commercially. How's that plan going at the moment?
Right. So two countries are actually the first countries, Israel and Denmark. And we're following that with Australia, mostly because people said this can only work in small countries. And we figured out, well, let's go take a big island. And Australia feels big enough to actually prove that it can work everywhere. Israel's on target. We'll have about 40 stations by the end of the year and about 56 stations by middle of next year. And we're about to start tests with consumers in the middle of this year. So serial production car, our stations will actually be tested in Israel middle of the year. We'll probably run with that for about 6 months. And if everything, all the quirks are ironed out, everything is working well, by the end of the year, we'll start our controlled release of cars to consumers on an open network.
Will there be a standard way of changing batteries, for example, that mean that you can do this with anywhere?
So we don't expect any standards to emerge in the short term. I think long term, there may be a possibility of somebody going out to a Renault or Nissan saying, can I get your battery? I'll use it in my car. And we've seen that happen in the car industry. People license technologies from one another. But in the beginning, we will work with manufacturers, and we work with Renault to get their cars and fit their cars with their stations. Renault's doing a lineup of cars, so they've already announced 4 cars. Nissan's announced 5 cars. So there's a lineup of these cars that are coming up. Eventually, you'll see other makers, and we're dealing mostly with Asian makers right now, China being the largest car manufacturer in the world. We wanted to get some Chinese car makers to work with us. I think eventually you'll see most of the car makers in the world go into EVs. We've seen all of them announce electric vehicles to date.
Have any American car companies come on board?
They've had a hard time. We got to realize that car companies went through the worst economic downturn in the industry for about almost 70 years, since 1930-31. We're in engagements and conversations with most car makers. It will probably take them 3 years to sort of catch up to the ability that Renault has put. And Renault started in 2007, so we're seeing a 4-year advantage Renault has on the market.
Are you going to come to the UK at some point?
Well, we hope to. I think the one part missing in the UK is the clarity of government regulation. So we need, when we come in and do a project like this, it's a fairly extensive infrastructure project. It takes a lot of investment. Investors want to see clarity on the regulatory framework that would indicate that the government will stand and support this for a long period of time, not just for a short number of cars or a small number of cars or a short period of time.
What kind of support do you need from governments in this situation, and what's missing in the UK?
I'll tell you what we're getting in the rest of the world, and we're seeing that happen. Most countries around the world are now putting incentives towards the consumers, and I think that they're sending a message to the consumer that they would like to see the early adopters get to about, I would say, 2-3% of the car population with support from the government. And that support comes in the form of usually either a tax incentive. Israel, for example, put a delta. There's a 72% tax on petrol car and 10% on gasoline, on electric cars. Denmark outdid that. They have 180% tax on petrol car and zero on zero emission cars. But then we're seeing similar signals. In France, for example, there's a 5,000 euro incentive towards electric cars. In China, there's an $8,800 incentive towards electric car. In Japan, actually $12,000 towards electric cars. U.S. is $7,500. And in all these places, these incentives are in place for hundreds of thousands of cars. U.S., for example, is 200,000 cars by brand. So you're looking at sort of a significant long-term signal by the government that says, if you put the infrastructure and if you can convince the consumers, we're not going to pull the rug from underneath you as you start to get the population in. We need something like that from the UK government.
In your head, you must have a ranking of governments out there that are doing well when it comes to electric car infrastructure. So we all need to do this at some point. Different governments are doing it in different ways, some not at all. Do you have in your head sort of a top three, and where does the UK fit in your list?
The approaches taken by government to regulatory frameworks around electric cars have been distinctly different. China has taken the Chinese approach. So China has put together the top 16 firms in China that relate to to this topic and basically told them, we're going to go electric, we're going to go switching batteries, and we're going to do it quickly. And there were car companies in there, and the guy was running the grid, and that's the Chinese way, right? They put $9,000, an $8,800 incentive. They gave the money to the cities, to the top 13 cities, to go build the infrastructure. And by and large, if you look at history, every such infrastructure project that the Chinese have embarked on was done within time. So, check, China's going to be done, right? Now, we fail to recognize it, but China this year will make more cars than Europe and US combined. So, the Chinese didn't look at it as an environmental decision. They basically figured out something that most of the West hasn't. They will never be able to make an engine that's better than Daimler's, right? They will never be able to make an engine that will run like a BMW M5. But they can make an electric motor that runs better than anything made in Germany, and they can make it in mass. They can't manufacture oil, but they can manufacture as many batteries as they want. And so they've realized they got an opportunity to leapfrog the car industry, the global car industry, and then with their volumes, nobody will ever be able to catch up. And they can get off their dependency on oil, which has been adding 1 million barrels a year, every year for the last 2-3 years.
I guess also it makes a great export opportunity for them.
It's a fantastic export opportunity. Now, the impact of Germany waiting for 3 years or 5 years and China making a great electric car and then putting it into the body of a European car, which they might have just bought, called Volvo or Saab, and making a great European quality electric car, had totally escaped the German market. Because these guys may actually turn into a European market and say, here's a 10,000 euro electric car that drives better than any gasoline car you've got. And at that point in time, they'll do the same to the German cars as they've done to Sony's music player or to laptops from the US. I mean, they'll basically take over an industry never to be caught again. So China, by and large, ranked number one. If you're looking across Europe, there's a very big difference between France and Germany. The French started from a point of perspective that said, we have infinite number of electrons. We're a nuclear power, so we got supply mostly at night that nobody knows what to do with. We give it away.
Clean electrons, crucially.
I don't want to argue whether it's clean or not clean, yeah. But it's there. It's electrons, right? And they're saying, we're manufacturing them anyway. We can't stop these things. So today we give them away. Why not use them to replace oil? And when Renault picked up on the electric trend and made the car, they suddenly had the yin-yang. They had the electrons, the cars, and the batteries all in their hands. And I think the French are going to lead well ahead of the Germans, who are trying to protect their industry of diesel and diesel improvements and things of that nature. And I think that delta will continue to grow until Germany switches over to electric from denial, which is where they are right now. I think the U.S. is to a certain degree the wild card in this play. U.S. has been burnt to a certain degree in the early in the last decade with the EV1 experience and the RAV4 experience back in the U.S. And until the Volt came back into the market, which just
the Chevrolet car,
Chevy Volt, which is if you want an electric car without an infrastructure. So instead of having the better place infrastructure around, what they do is they carry their own infrastructure in the trunk. They carry a generator in the trunk. But it would be a fantastic introduction to the early adopters of electric cars. It would be a $40,000, $41,000 car, which is not for everyone, right? But it will show people that it's a great car. It will be a fun car to drive. And then when that car, with that kind of drive, with that kind of silent power, will be available under $20,000, with an infrastructure around it to support it, the mass markets will start adopting. And so the Chevy Volt will serve the early adopters, much like the Tesla served the early skeptics who said you can't build a fast electric car, and they showed that actually the fastest car you can build is electric. And I think those early proof points will become sort of the road on which all the other guys will drive, eventually with a sub-$20,000 switchable electric car coming into the market, I would say in about 3-4 years' time.
You've gone specifically for electric battery-operated vehicles. Other sort of technologies for clean cars or environmentally friendly cars are fuel cells, for example, in the future, hydrogen. Are you betting against all of those things and saying that none of those will be scalable and the infrastructure is different? Or do you think they might also have a future, but you're focusing on this?
We've looked at all these options. So we didn't start with electric cars. The question I started with is, how do you run a country without oil? Not how do you build a battery and switching device, and then what do you do with it, right? So we didn't start with the mousetrap trying to go look for mice. We actually looked at the entirety of the problem. Every one of the solutions we've seen to date fails on one or more of the fronts that we've declared as, if you want, the fundamental posit of this market. You have to offer a car that will be cheaper and more convenient to the consumer. And then ask them to pay the same as petrol to drive a mile. If you start with a fuel cell car, you're starting with an electric car, but with a storage device that is not very smart, right? So if you look at an electric car, you got a battery that stores electrons, and all you need to do is send the electrons back and forth. And we've got a machine that sends electrons at the speed of light, which is called the grid. We use it because we like lights. We turn on light and we want to see a light bulb turn on. And we've built that machine over the last 120 years. Interestingly enough, the grid is the biggest machine ever built by humans. And it's hard to rebuild it. The hydrogen guys want you to believe that if we had hydrogen everywhere, it would have been really easy to go build a car. The problem with it is you need to build a whole new infrastructure to distribute electrons in the form of hydrogen molecules. And the hydrogen molecule is 2,000 times bigger and heavier than the electron. So this is like taking a drop of water or taking an email and printing it down onto a piece of paper and putting it into a FedEx envelope and sending it to somebody instead of just sending an email. And then they tell you, but you know, we have new ways of packaging it. We can package it in alloys, in metals. That's as if you not only took the FedEx, you actually sent the guy the airplane to their home to get them the email, right? It's the scientific logic in it escapes most people.
You've got some high profile backers and people who think this is a great thing. Arnie Schwarzenegger, for example, you can't argue with anything he says. And Bill Clinton's been very positive about it. However, how has your technology, your idea been received in the industry? There is a big electric car industry out there that doesn't do the things you're doing. They don't want switch stations. They want charge points in your home and that sort of thing. How are they responding to it?
I think when you get into an industry, you know, the incumbents always have a hard time accepting a new idea. I mean, you go back a decade, 1999 or 2000, Sony won a big court case against something called Napster. Remember Napster? And they killed MP3. The iPod is still not out 10 years ago. So we live with iPods around us, but it was invented in 2001. Sony at the time dominated the entire industry. And if you asked anybody in the industry, what are the odds kids will run around with hard disks or flash memory in their pockets with music on it, Sony would tell you it's nuts, right? Sony, the absolute controller of the entire supply chain, they had a music studio, a label. You go into New York's Sony store today, Fifth Avenue, there is a bigger section for iPod accessories in the store than for Sony's music players. This is just a decade ago. Since then, the iPod revolution actually revived the iMac, created the iPhone, and created the iPad. When the iPad came out, the entire industry said, who needs a third computer? Right? It's not a phone, it's not a laptop, it's in between. Who will carry another device that's a tablet device? And by the way, we've tried tablet devices many, many times. They didn't work. iPads came out, and within a month, sales for laptops went down 35% across the industry. Everybody in the industry who's looking at the iPad now tells you that there are 36 other devices that came out at the Consumer Electronics Show. The odds for Apple sustaining that kind of success, which was the same guys predicted a year ago, will not be a success. The odds for them sustaining the success, slim to none. iPads outsold the entire industry, all 36 other tablets, in the first week of the year, for the entire year. Now, don't ever ask the incumbent, what do they think about the newcomer? They will always tell you it's not going to work. Denial is not a river in Egypt.
Shai Agassi there, founder and chief executive of sustainable transport company Better Place. If you're on Twitter, you can follow this podcast. Just search for Science Weekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all of the Guardian Science content, follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Away from switching to the redundant send sequencer. T-minus 27 seconds. We have gone for redundant set sequencer start. T-minus 20 seconds and counting.
First venture into space. Two American astronauts are poised and waiting to add a new dimension to space travel.
T-minus 15, 14, 13. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. We've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start. Space shuttle. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
On the 12th of April, 1981, Columbia first blasted off from Cape Canaveral.
Now I can eagle.
This year, 30 years on, the space shuttle fleet will finally be taken out of service.
434, Max Cube, are you?
Roger.
The three remaining shuttles, Discovery, Atlantis, and Endeavour, each have one mission left.
Columbia, Houston, you're go at throttle up.
Roger, go at throttle up.
At the time of recording, NASA has scheduled STS-133 for this week, the 24th of February. Discovery is destined for the International Space Station.
Columbia, you're go for SRB SEP.
Back in the 80s and 90s, Dr. Jeffrey Hoffman made a total of 5 space flights on the shuttle and was the first astronaut to log more than 1,000 hours of flight time on board.
Roger on the SEP, Columbia.
Mark, 2 minutes, 20 seconds.
But after 3 decades, what's the shuttle's legacy? And what's next for human spaceflight?
As the spacecraft reaches into orbit and prepares for to make its first circular orbit of the Earth, we'll say that our CBS News coverage of the flight, and we can now say flight of spacecraft Columbia, will continue after this pause for station identification.
We spoke to Jeff, who's now working at the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's presenting a new documentary looking at the end of the space shuttle.
Mark, 3 minutes 40 seconds, standing by for a return status check and mission control by Flight Director Neil Hutchinson. Columbia given a green to continue.
30 years. And, over 130 flights for the shuttle fleet. It didn't fly as often as people were originally hoping, but nevertheless, it's been an extraordinary machine. The versatility of the shuttle, the different roles that it's played, are just unprecedented in the history of spaceflight, and probably are not going to be duplicated in the foreseeable future. I mean, the shuttle is not only transportation into space, but once it's up in orbit, we've used it to launch satellites. We've used it with the space lab built by the European Space Agency as a scientific laboratory. We've used it for engineering tests. We've used it for repairing satellites in space, for bringing satellites back home to be repaired on the ground and relaunched.
Endeavour has a firm handshake with Mr. Hubble's telescope.
We copy that, Kevin, and there are smiles galore down here.
We used it to extend the life of the Russian Mir space station by several years, and of course now it's just in its final phases being used for the construction and now the completion and supply of the International Space Station. So it's been a multi-purpose machine that has done things that were never possible to do in space without the capabilities of a large vehicle like the shuttle. We're going to miss it when it's gone.
And Houston, if you copy, Jeff's just working, putting the doors back together and thinks he's found a way that seems to close the gap, and we're going to try that, if that's okay.
It was supposed to be a cheap way to get into space. Why did that not happen? Why was it so expensive?
Well, the original concept behind the shuttle was modeled after airplanes. The idea that if you had to build a new airplane every time you flew from New York to London, transatlantic flight would never have become a commercial endeavor, and people wouldn't be doing it so much. And the idea was reusability, and the mantra was, if you can reuse it, it will be cheaper. The thing was, you know, when you think about it, the shuttle was the first reusable spacecraft, and people didn't know anything about building a reusable spacecraft. It was an extraordinary undertaking. You know, if this had been done in maybe a more rational way, we would have continued to fly the Apollo hardware, the Saturn rockets and the Apollo capsules, while we built a small reusable vehicle like one of the X planes, and actually learn what was involved in reusability. But no, we undertook this, the whole the shuttle, you know, this huge vehicle, and it's remarkable that it's worked as well as it had. I mean, obviously it's not a perfect vehicle, and we've had a couple of disasters, but nevertheless, it's accomplished amazing things. But when you talk to the engineers who designed all the different systems, they knew how to build the systems, and that's why the shuttle works, but they didn't know how to make things reusable. So, you know, for various reasons, NASA, the Office of Management and Budget, Congress, they basically decreed that the shuttle should fly, you know, several dozen times a year, because that's what you had to do in order to make the economic calculations look reasonable. The thing is, when you're flying a shuttle, you have a huge workforce, and that's where the money is going. I mean, we don't send dollar bills up in space. We use them to pay the people who prepare and operate the shuttle for flight. And you're paying that standing army whether you fly once a year or 50 times a year. Sure, there's a little bit of extra cost for the fuel and the external tank, which gets burned up after every flight. But it was just never possible to fly the shuttle safely more than, I think, 9 times was the most we ever flew in a year. And nowadays we fly just, you know, 3 or 4 times a year. And so the huge fixed cost has to be amortized over just a small number of flights. And so the cost per flight is not nearly as low as people had originally hoped. But we've learned an awful lot about reusable vehicles. So the next time around, I think we'll know a lot more. As well, of course, the shuttle was the first real winged vehicle that went into orbit, and every time it comes back through the atmosphere, it enters the atmosphere at 25 times the speed of sound. So we've built up an enormous database on hypersonic flight, which is going to be extremely useful for the next generation of winged vehicles.
4, 3, 2, 1... And liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Challenger. Challenger now heading downrange. Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have no downlink.
We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded.
Do you think the shuttle would be flying beyond 2011 if Challenger and Columbia had still been around?
Very good question. And, you know, NASA on numerous occasions throughout the history of the shuttle conducted studies on what should we do in the future. You know, should we build a new vehicle, or should we put the money into refurbishing the shuttle and keeping it flying?
Columbia continuing toward Florida, now approaching the New Mexico-Texas border.
And Columbia, Houston, we see your tire pressure messages, and we did not copy your last.
Roger.
And that was the last we heard, apart from a burst of static.
I think even as late as the Columbia accident, just before that, most people were assuming that the shuttle would be flying into the early 20s at least, you know, sort of the model of the the B-52, which was brought into service in the late 50s, and they're still flying. The environment of space, though, is a lot more severe than what airplanes undergo. And I think it was certainly after Columbia, people just had to realize that, it's time. The shuttle, it's getting old. The maintenance requirements are getting more and more severe in order to be able to continue to fly safely. And we need to do something new. And that's, I think, when the final decision was made that the shuttle should be retired. And I think that's the right thing to do. As I say, we're going to miss the shuttle because all the capabilities that it's given us to operate in low Earth orbit. But from NASA's point of view, we're going to turn over the transport to low Earth orbit, to the space station and any other places in near the Earth that we want to go to. In the U.S., that's going to be given to private industry who will operate rockets on their own. The rockets won't belong to NASA. NASA will basically buy the launch services, and that will allow NASA to concentrate on building the next generation of rocket, which will be a heavy lift launch vehicle, which finally, several decades after the end of Apollo, will give us the ability once again to leave Earth's orbit and start exploring back to the moon, near-Earth asteroids, someday the moons of Mars, the surface of Mars. You know, there's a lot of things we'd like to do, with the money, hopefully, that NASA will save by not having to operate the shuttle and provide the whole infrastructure, it'll be able to put more resources into exploration, which is really what NASA should be doing, rather than running a taxi service between the surface of the Earth and the International Space Station. So that's what I hope we'll see in the future. The future still has to be created, and there's a lot of work between here and there, but that's the way things are shaping up.
Well, I guess this is the big question at the moment, isn't it? After Discovery and Atlantis and Endeavour all go up for the last time this year, what's next for NASA's human spaceflight program?
Well, human spaceflight, not just for NASA, but for most of the spacefaring world, with the exception of the Chinese, the human spaceflight is the International Space Station. And we will continue to operate the space station. I think there's big challenges ahead in turning the space station into a working scientific lab and being able to conduct useful and hopefully productive research up there. So that's going to be the focus near the Earth. And in the meantime, NASA is going to be working with industry on developing this large rocket, which when it's finally flying, once again, will give us the ability to explore beyond the Earth, which I think is what inspired so many people about Apollo. And I'd like to see that come back.
We will invest more than $3 billion to conduct research on an advanced heavy lift rocket, a vehicle to efficiently send into orbit the crew capsules, propulsion systems.
When Obama canceled the Constellation program, What were your feelings at that point?
Well, I had been enthusiastic about Constellation because I liked the idea of reusing some of the shuttle hardware and getting back to the moon as quickly as we could. But Constellation was never funded at the level that the Bush administration promised, and it was falling further and further behind schedule, and the projected costs were continually escalating.
Our second goal is to develop and test a new spacecraft, the Crew Exploration Vehicle. The Crew Exploration Vehicle will be capable of ferrying astronauts and scientists to the space station after the shuttle is retired.
A lot of us had come to be skeptical that Constellation was ever going to reach its goal. It could have if the money had been there. And so we needed to do something to change the paradigm because, another big crash program like Apollo was just not going to happen. I mean, Apollo was a very unique time in history. It was the Cold War, and there was a very robust American economy,
And it was all something new, and I don't think those elements are ever going to come together. So affordability has become much more critical in our space activities, and we really have a challenge now to build a rocket that we can operate affordably and conduct an exploration program on a much more limited budget than we had in Apollo. I think it can be done if there's the political will. And we'll just have to see how things evolve. I hope it will happen, because I'd hate to think that, 100 years from now, people will look back and say, yes, back in the 1960s and early 70s, we actually left the Earth and went to the moon. Wasn't that a wonderful thing to do? I wonder why we've never done it again. That would be tragic.
Airspeed 271 knots. Fido says it couldn't be any better.
Former NASA astronaut Jeff Hoffman. You can listen to Jeff's documentary, Last Chance to Fly the Space Shuttle, at bbc.co.uk/worldservice. If you're into all things space, you can also listen to our entire interview with Jeff, and let's be honest, who doesn't enjoy listening to astronauts, someone who's actually been into space? That's on the latest Science Weekly Extra podcast, which should be on your podcast feed right now. There are links to all of that on our Facebook group. Search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast.
Welcome home, Columbia. Beautiful, beautiful.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
That's nearly it for another week. Thanks to Shai Agassi, Jeff Hoffman and James Randerson. Next week, I'll be presenting a special programme from Washington, D.C. at this year's AAAS, the world's biggest science conference. And to finish this show, a song about yeast. It's after artist Gethin Dick teamed up with six biomedical students from University College London to make songs about their research. In one track, guitars copy an optical frequency graph. In another, a beatboxer channels an MRI scanner. The album's called Trying and Trying and Trying. The link's on our blog. As you've probably come to expect from this podcast by now, especially after a couple of weeks covering the intricacies of animal mating, we've chosen a track on a similar theme. This is called The Sex Life of Yeast. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Live all over Nicaragua and Costa Rica, and over about 10,000
5,000 years, each frog population has evolved its own unique set of colours and designs. Orange with turquoise legs, yellow with sky blue toes, dark blue all over with light blue stripes, green and black spots or speckles or polka dots or splotches or squiggles. The colour makes no odds to them, they're all poisonous to everything anyway. But every population's different, and in each population, the frogs are all the same. The only reason this has happened is females prefer to fuck a frog that has the same colour and pattern as them. Everyone else has died. This is how it happens. You can do it with maths. Lay a freshie down for me. Play around with me. Write to me in pencil. Talk to me in size. Give your head to me. Sharpen all your legs for me. Lean back, close your eyes and rub one out. Lay a freshie down for me. Play around with me. Write to me in pencil. Talk to me in size. Give your head to me. Sharpen all your legs for me. Lean back, close your eyes and rub one out. In common jungle fowl, the males have all the pretty plumage, gold and bronze down their backs, and long arching tail feathers in shimmering blue and green and purple. The females pick a mate by how good the males look. Because the handsome birds know they're going to get plenty, they spunk a little less out in case they get another shot. Whereas the scruffy-looking specimens know it might be their only go, so they give it their everything on any chance they get. The result is that females who do drop their standards are more likely to have chicks by the scruff bag that they settled for. Everyone else dies. This is how it happens. You can do it with maths. Lay a freshie down for me. Play around with me. Write to me in pencil. Talk to me in size. Give your head to me. Sharpen all your legs for me. Lean back, close your eyes and rub one out. Yeast normally reproduces asexually and only has sex when times are hard. Think of its genome as a pack of cards. It copies them, shuffles them, and deals them out in four piles. Every pile has the same number, but some piles have the high cards. The cards signal to each other. Stronger genes signal clearer. Those piles move towards each other quicker and mate. The yeast cell splits. All the weak genes get ditched together. This is why yeast and any other creature, including you, has sex at all. And though the deck gets shuffled, your cards are marked. Play your hand. You stand to win or lose the future. Everyone else will die. This is how it happens. You can do it with maths. Lay a freshie down for me. Play around with me. Write to me in pencil. Talk to me in size. Give your head to me. Sharpen all your legs for me. Lean back. Close your eyes and rub one out. Lay a freshie down for me. Play around with me. Write to me in pencil. Talk to me in size. Give your head to me. Sharpen all your legs for me. Lean back. Close your eyes and rub one out.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.